From WCAI in Woods Hole and WGBH Radio Boston, this is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. 20 candidates for president took the stage for the first Democratic debate of the 2020 elections. Of course, it took two nights, and there are four more Democratic candidates that didn't even make the cut, plus the two Republicans. If it all seems a bit much, you're not alone, and it turns out you have math to back you up. Alexander Strang is a PhD candidate in math at Case Western Reserve University. He and his mentor, Peter Thomas, have written about an obscure mathematical principle called Condorcet's paradox, which suggests that a large number of candidates could make it difficult for voters to come to a consensus about which one is the best. Alex, welcome to Living Lab Radio.
Thank you.
Condorcet's paradox, this idea that if there are too many options, it may be hard for everybody to settle on one best option, seems kind of logical. But walk us through the math of how this actually works.
So the basic problem is that when there are many candidates, there are many more ways for people to disagree than for people to agree. And you can even see that if you just look at people's first choice. So suppose we have 24 candidates and we sample two random Democratic voters who are planning on voting in the primary. And we ask the two voters, who is your favorite candidate? Who would you pick first? Since there are 24 candidates, there's 24 ways for them to agree. Maybe they both say Joe Biden, maybe they both say Kamala Harris. However, because there are 24 candidates, there are many more ways for them to disagree than there were for the ways for them to agree. So in fact, with 24 candidates, there are 23 times more ways for them to have a different answer than to have the same answer. And this problem gets more protracted the more candidates you include. And it also gets more difficult when you ask more complicated questions. So if we're using a voting system that's called a ranked voting system, that's a system where you vote by listing all your candidates in order of preference. And with 24 candidates, there are 620 billion trillion different possible rankings. So the chance that if people were just picking random rankings that they'd agree is very, very slim.
620 billion trillion. I mean, that's a really huge number. But realistically, people aren't just randomly putting candidates into order or randomly picking the one candidate that they vote for.
And even going back to just if you asked 24 actual Democratic voters who their favorite choice was, because about 35% have so far polled for Joe Biden and about 18 for Bernie Sanders and so on, the actual chance that they agree instead of being 4%, which would be the chance when they're totally drawn at random, is about an 18% chance.
Still not great odds, though.
Right. Still not great odds. So what the Condorcet's paradox is it's a particular case where there's essentially not enough agreement in the electorate to pick a clear winner in an election. And so the simplest case is when you have three voters and three candidates. And this example is intentionally simple because it's meant to point out how these systems can fail even in what seem like very easy cases. So suppose you have three candidates. One represents the Rock Party. They're down to earth. One represents the Scissors Party, and one represents paper. Now, maybe voter one prefers the Rock Party because he likes their simple common sense solutions. Voter two likes the Scissor Party because they're sort of cutting edge. And voter three prefers paper. If we just ran a regular election and we asked them all, who is your first choice? Clearly, there'd be no winner. It would be a three-way tie. So we say, okay, let's ask for more information, right? If we can't decide based on your first choice, who's your second choice and who's your third? Suppose that voter one prefers the first candidate to the second and the second candidate to the third. Suppose voter two prefers the second candidate to the third and the third candidate to the first. And finally, suppose that the third voter prefers candidate three to candidate one and candidate one to candidate two. Now we have essentially all of the information in the system. We know all of the voters' preferences. We might hope that this would resolve our problem. The problem is that if you set up the voter preferences in this way, they're totally symmetric. And so two would beat one, three would beat two, and one would beat three. And so it really becomes a rock, paper, scissors system, and there is no way, fair way to pick a winner.
Alexander Strang, I wonder how not only the number of candidates factors in, but also the number of voters, because it's a different situation if you have three candidates and three voters, and there's really no way to break that tie. But if you have 3,000 voters or 3 million voters, that would seem to make a difference.
Yes. And it really matters how the electorate is structured. So in the example given in our article, we use a case that's simple to treat mathematically. And that's the case where each voter votes independently. So my opinions don't depend on my family's opinions, which of course is an unrealistic assumption.
Unfortunately, yes.
The other assumption is that the voters' preferences are uniformly distributed, which means that they are equally likely to put Joe Biden at the top of the ballot as the bottom of the ballot. If you do that, then increasing the number of voters actually increases the chance that this paradox arises.
But if they're not doing it randomly...
Right. If they're not uniformly distributed, if instead you're using a statistical model that more closely matches an actual electorate, then increasing the number of voters decreases the chance of the paradox. And you actually see that if you look at real elections. That elections with a large electorate are rarely show the paradox, whereas elections among a small electorate with many candidates may show the paradox.
So that was going to be my next question, Alexander Strang, which is how much evidence is there that Condorcet's paradox, while it seems very logical in a theoretical sense, how much evidence is there that it actually happens in real life and perhaps is a factor in how elections are playing out?
It depends on the type of election that you look at. So in general, it's rare, but it is also a particularly strong paradox. And so usually when it occurs is situations among a legislature. So actually a sort of famous example is the vote on what was called the Wilmot Proviso. Right at the end of the Mexican-American War, Congress was deciding how much land to annex from Mexico. And there were essentially three proposals. The first was to take as much land as possible and to let it be either a free state or a slave state up to the choice of the people who lived there. The second proposal was to take the land, but to ensure that no slavery would be allowed, so ensure that they would be free states. And the third proposal was to do neither. And what happened at the time, there were about eight parties in the Congress, and the way people voted actually showed the paradox. So the option to take land and allow slavery beat the option to take land and to not allow slavery, 120 votes to 41. While the option to take land and forbid slavery beat the option to keep the status quo, 103 to 58. However, the option to keep the status quo beat the option to take land and to allow slavery, 90 to 71, which is exactly the Condorcet paradox.
This situation that we're seeing this year with 24 Democratic candidates for president, I mean, 2016, we had more than a dozen Republican candidates for president. These seem like relatively new situations, but you're citing an historical situation going back more than 100 years. And I wonder, where did this paradox, Condorcet's paradox, come from originally? Clearly, it wasn't coined for the 2020 elections.
No. So Condorcet was a marquis in France at the end of the 18th century. He was a mathematician, but he was also an Enlightenment thinker. He advocated for various reforms that today we would see as fairly egalitarian. So advocates for democracy, advocates for a free economy, for rights for women, for abolitionism. And part of the whole movement, the Enlightenment movement, was founded on rational thinking about systems of government and what systems of government are the most fair, are the most representative, and so on. And Condorcet was part of this. He studied election systems because he was interested in what makes a fair government and how do you discern the will of the people, if you will, from a collection of individual preferences. Another French mathematician at the time, Borda, was interested in a similar problem and proposed what's called the Borda count election system, which is a simple version of a ranked election system. Each voter casts a vote for their top three candidates, and 3 points are awarded to the first candidate, 2 for the second, and 1 for the third. And then the points are summed, and the candidate with the most points wins. Condorcet disagreed with Borda that this was sort of an optimal system and disagreed fairly publicly. They had a protracted argument in the press and eventually sort of fell out with each other.
It's interesting that the entire history of this goes back to something that's now a very present day conversation and debate again about how do we run our elections, what's the best way, and in fact, ranked voting systems are coming back into the conversation and into the debate. Does understanding the math of Condorcet's paradox point toward any particular workarounds or solutions for dealing with these elections with such a large number of candidates?
Yes. So Condorcet's paradox is often used as a starting point. It's introduced because it's a little bit shocking and because it's fairly simple, right? The example with three candidates and three voters is easy to explain. The reason that Condorcet was disturbed by this is he was looking for a ranked voting system that would try to find a consensus winner when there are many different candidates and there's a big diversity of opinion. So what he proposed was that every voter should provide all of their preferences. So if there are 24 candidates, you would need to write down all 24 candidates in order, which is a difficult task. But from the mathematician's perspective, it gives you a lot of information to work with. What you can do if you have everybody's preferences, all 24 candidates ranked from all the voters, is you can essentially simulate what would happen if any two of them ran against each other alone. Condorcet said that the fairest way to pick a winner is to find a candidate who would win an election against any other candidate in the pool. If that person exists, they're called a Condorcet winner, and it's sort of generally agreed within social choice theory that that's a fairly fair way to pick a winner. The problem is, if the Condorcet's paradox arises, then there is no Condorcet winner. The Condorcet winner doesn't exist. And so in a sense, there is no consensus opinion, and it makes it very difficult to come up with a fair way to pick a winner.
And of course, all of that is predicated on the idea that we have that complete information from all voters, that we have the complete rankings, which at the moment is not how our electoral system works.
And we have fairly limited information. We only know who the first choice of most voters is. And most polls are only asking about the first choice. Some ask about second choices. The board account, which is, again, you give 3 points to your first choice, 2 to your second, 1 to your third, is attractive because it kind of mixes the two approaches. You're giving more information than just about your first choice, your first preference, but you don't need to come up with a list of all 24 candidates. So I think that somewhat ironically, the instant runoff voting system, which was just adopted in Maine for their primaries, is a reasonable, practical system that might help when you have a large group of candidates.
Alexander Strang is a PhD candidate in mathematics at Case Western Reserve University. He and his mentor, Peter Thomas, have written about Condorcet's paradox and its implications for the current Democratic primaries for theconversation.com. Alex, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And now, an unfortunate update on a story we've been following for 2 years, and that's the decline of North Atlantic right whales. There are just over 400 individuals remaining, and there were 6 deaths in the month of June. That's over 1% of the entire remaining population. And it's reminiscent of the summer of 2017, when 18 whales died. Many of them were hit by ships or got tangled in fishing gear, and the majority of those deaths happened in the same area near the Gulf of St. Lawrence, where the whales are now. Peter Corcoran leads the large whale research program at NOAA's Northeast Fisheries Science Center, and he joins me now. Peter, welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much, Heather. It's a pleasure to be here.
Tell us a little bit about the whales that we know have died. I mean, these whales have names. We know their ages. We know their life stories.
Yeah. I mean, thanks to the catalog that the New England Aquarium in particular keeps, we have a unfortunately detailed knowledge of these particular animals. So the first one who died was Wolverine, so named because he's got sort of three slashes on his back. That looks like Wolverine's trademark.
But of course came from a ship, not from a Wolverine.
Yeah, I don't think there are that many Marvel superheroes out in the ocean. and he was about 9 when he died. So he was a young male about to reach maturity. Then there was Punctuation, who died, and she's just been necropsied. And she's a really sad story because she was a 40-plus-year-old adult female who'd had at least 8 calves. We know she was a grandma.
And that's really important when you've got a declining population.
Oh, absolutely. You know, and she was one of the good reproducers of North Atlantic right whales. She was hit by a vessel and killed her, looks like, almost instantly. And those couple of whales, when they were found dead, they were very fresh. And then there's been an 11-year-old female, and there was another adult male that died as well. And I don't know about the fifth animal. I don't think that they've worked out who that is yet because it's very recent.
I mean, the one death in early June, I called you. I said, okay, are we looking at a repeat of 2017? And you said, you know, it's one animal. It's unfortunate, but it's too early to panic. It's a month later, and we're now at five deaths. Is it time to panic now? Is this a repeat of 2017?
Well, panicking seems appropriate, yes. In terms of a repeat, you know, whether the reasons these whales are dying are the same as last time is unclear. I mean, one of the things that came out very recently is a paper from folks from the National Fund for Animal Welfare and a bunch of other folks who showed that when they looked at, you know, 15 years of necropsies of whales, that apart from brand newborn babies, every single animal that was North Atlantic right whale that was found dead that we knew why it died, died because people killed it. So, you know, these animals, a reasonable assumption is they're dying because people are killing them. So the good thing is it means that we can solve that. We just have to stop killing them.
So one of the concerns is that these whales are up near the Gulf of St. Lawrence in a similar area to where they were in 2017 when there were so many deaths related to ship strikes and entanglement in fishing gear. But then last year, they were also up near the Gulf of St. Lawrence, and we saw no fatalities. Do we know what the difference is and why we might be seeing, you know, a really bad year, a fine year, now perhaps a really bad year again?
Well, some of the differences are kind of subtle from a whale's point of view, but a lot less subtle from a human point of view. So last year, well, the Canadians instituted a lot of fairly stringent restrictions on what people could do, and they blocked off areas to protect whales. And the whales were kind of distributed in a north-south line running down, and the very northernmost whales were up near the sort of shipping channels that go into the big cities in Canada. And this year so far, I mean, it's still early days for the data, but this year so far, the distribution of whales has been more kind of east-west and closer to the shipping lanes. So, you know, maybe that's had an effect. And you know, from a whale's point of view, it's all the same place. It's like going to one coffee shop rather than another. But, you know, for how we manage killing them, it becomes really important.
Yeah, I mean, that subtle difference of a few of the whales are close to the shipping channel as opposed to all of the whales are lining the side of the shipping channel is a huge difference.
Yeah.
We have a system here near Boston where the shipping channel is actually lined with listening buoys that literally keeps an ear out for right whales and alerts vessels. Is there any sort of system like that in place in these Canadian waters?
So there's a couple of things going on. One is there's a fairly substantial aerial survey effort going on to assess where whales are. And as well, there's work that's collaborative work between folks, Mark Baumgartner from Woods Hole Oceanographic and Chris Taggart's lab at Dalhousie University and Kim Davies, who's at another university in Canada now. And they have a couple of Slocum gliders out that are detecting whales, but they're a bit further south of where the main concentrations are that we've seen from the aerial surveys so far.
This seems to be a really hard problem to actually even get our heads around what scale we need to be regulating at, how we need to be responding to this.
Absolutely. And the problem's confounded by the fact that there's just so few of these whales. You know, we can't afford to lose five.
I mean, that's, yeah, over 1% of the population in a matter of a month.
Yeah.
What does that turn into long term?
Well, I mean, particularly losing an adult female and a female who is about to reach adulthood is a huge problem because, you know, they're not going to have any more babies. And, you know, if babies aren't born, then the rest of the species are just dead whales swimming.
Hmm. Peter Corcoran leads the Large Whale Research Program at NOAA's Northeast Fisheries Science Center, giving us an update on North Atlantic right whales who are currently largely in Canadian waters, and we've seen a major uptick in deaths in the past month. Peter, thanks.
Thank you so much, Heather.
Up next, making summer break work for the teenage brain. Living Lab Radio continues after a short break. This is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. The teen brain. It's long been an enigma to parents. In recent years, it's also become a hot topic for brain researchers. And what they've learned has surprised many. Teens aren't just inexperienced adults. Their brains are still developing, and the result is a unique set of both strengths and potential weaknesses for teens and their parents to work with. Frances Jensen is chair of the neurology department at University of Pennsylvania and author of The Teenage Brain, a neuroscientist's survival guide to raising adolescents and young adults. She says summer break provides great opportunities for teen brain development. Frances, good to have you back on the show.
Great to have a chance to talk about this.
Tell me, how different is the teen brain? It's not just an inexperienced version of the adult brain, but physically, physiologically, how different is it?
Well, it is not an adult brain yet. The brain is actually constructing its most important elements during the teen years and kind of higher order functioning, executive function, social functioning are all areas of the brain that are being constructed and connected during this window. So it is different from childhood. Childhood is characterized by an ability for brain connections to be made very quickly, for learning. And teenagers also have this opportunity. We call it plasticity, the ability of the brain to morph itself to experience. And this is happening in the teen years. Was not appreciated that it was happening past childhood until probably about a decade ago. And now we realize that it's happening well into the mid to later 20s as well, this opportunity to really gain skills in a much more rapid way than you could as an adult.
So that's the good news. There's rapid learning ability as a teen, but there are also some potential pitfalls involved with, you know, working with a brain that, as you said, is not fully constructed and not fully connected.
Yes. So the brain actually sort of connects itself from the back to the front. So the last place that gets fully connected is the frontal lobe. And the frontal lobe is our seat of decision making, judgment, empathy, impulse control, organizational behavior, all those good things are last to be fully online. It's not that the teenagers don't have frontal lobes, it's that they're not connecting them rapidly to other parts of the brain. So in terms of risk-taking, this is why we believe they are really skilled risk-takers, if you will, and are not necessarily connecting the causality of maybe the consequences of a risk. So that puts them in a more vulnerable position. Although that same risk-taking is captured with novelty-seeking. So that's something obviously teenagers do a lot of. And actually there's some very good signs to novelty-seeking, trial and error, seeking out, trying new things, learning new skills. But they do have this propensity to take risks. And in addition, some of the risks, the experiences they may subject themselves to through risk-taking can leave indelible marks on their brain. Because if you remember what I said, they are also kind of learning machines like right. children are. And they learn learn good things, but they can also learn bad things. So this is the reason why teenagers, and young adults can get addicted harder, longer, stronger, faster than an adult, because their brains can unfortunately adapt too quickly, too well to bad things as well as good things. The more we learn, we realize that this is something that we need to sort of think about in managing their environment a little bit and being mindful when your teenager comes home and, you know, you say, oh, you're crazy. Why would you do that? Realizing that there is biology behind some of their maybe less sensible decisions. And rather than like getting really angry at them and alienating them because they need you. You know, adults have frontal lobes that are connected. And I always say it's time we think about giving them frontal lobe assists, helping them with decision making, planning, and assessing risks and heads up about risks they may not see ahead of them that we can so clearly see as likely to happen.
Well, Frances Jensen, you have spent a lot of time not only studying the teen brain, the physiology, the neurobiology, but then also trying to translate that for parents. And you say that summer is a particularly good time to practice perhaps some of those frontal lobe assists, trying to find that balance of giving teens enough rope, but not enough to hang themselves, I guess. What is it about summer that is such a great opportunity?
There's so many good things about summer. One is that the highly stressful school year is over. They can actually sleep. They have a little bit more control over their days. It is time for them to look inward and cultivate hobbies and skills that they may not have time for because of kind of our somewhat overly structured school year. So remembering to give them that space to explore what skill sets they have to develop something, develop a, you know, a sport or a musical hobby or reading or writing. It is also a time for them to take some sensible risks, trial and error, try out being accountable for things. They need to learn to be accountable. That is an actual skill that needs to be imprinted on their brains as well. And if we continue to, be helicopter parents or bulldozer parents and get everything done for them, they actually are going to learn helplessness. So giving them some chores, giving them some real life responsibilities, summer jobs that are manageable, that aren't overly stressful, and also time to relax and lower that general background of perceived anxiety. It's also a time to think about what's coming up in the year ahead. So I think parents are also taking a huge sigh of relief at the beginning of summer. And we tend to forget that, unfortunately, the school year starts in about 2.5 months.
All too soon.
Right. And, you know, you're past July 4th and you realize, oh, my goodness, the school supplies are being put up in the shops again. And we as parents have to think about the fact that these kids might be looking at college applications or they may be going to college, and thinking about in those two cases specifically what you can do from the family and also marshal help from the school system or other tutors and things if you need it for your teenager.
So let's really map that out. What in your mind would the ideal summer college process look like?
Well, first of all, making sure that the tone is relaxed rather than judgmental, frenetic, anxiety provoking. I think that is the most important piece, I would say, because their social brain is actually more connected. So it's connecting faster than their frontal lobes, because it's behind the frontal lobes, if you will. It's sort of in behind your ears. So remember that they are hyper aware of sort of anxiety. So take a more relaxed approach. And the only way you can really do that, I think, successfully is by starting early. So it's not trying to get all your college tours done in the end of August before school starts. So plan ahead, take a look, and taking a few of those college trips with your teenager, it gives you an opportunity to be one-on-one time, which is vanishingly, you know, rare in our society for an adult and their teenager on a road trip in a car. The longer it takes, the better, as far as I'm concerned. More stuff comes out when you're both staring at the road with no eye contact than you would ever believe. and get to know your child and get to have those minutiae type trivial conversations with them. But building this and going and watching how they react to an environment and sort of reminding them that the breadth of the yogurt bar is unlikely to be the reason why they should pick that college over another one. Mm. And, you know, that these things that appear very enticing are window dressing, and that to really look at, like, what is it about this college? But then to go, once you've looked at a few, even if it's only online or brochures, to work with your kid and kind of literally make one of those pros and cons. Like, I want to be in an urban environment. I don't want to be in an urban environment. Well, go to an urban school and make sure that the kid doesn't really want to be in an urban environment. Maybe it resonates with them and they just didn't know it because they don't have the experience yet. Right. So it's all about acquiring more experiences. You're filling their brain with more memory, filling your brain with more data points. That's what we need to be doing for these kids. And you know, show them the process of decision making.
I mean, you're bringing up over and over a really interesting and important and difficult part of this, which is striking that balance between helping them, but at the same time, this is their decision and something that they've got to make a choice about, right? You've got to give them also the independence to take ownership of this.
Exactly. And even more, that means that this sort of preparation is the right thing to do, because you want to trust your teenager. You want to get your teenager to a place where you trust the decision they're going to make. And you know that it's a relatively well-informed decision. And your role is to give them like as many sides of the story and as many tools to make that decision.
Well, Frances Jensen, you managed to talk a really good game and sound really upbeat about the teen years. But for those parents who perhaps really aren't enjoying the teen parenting experience, when does it end? When is the brain fully hooked up?
Okay, mid to late 20s. And males take a little longer than females. And I would say if there are parents that are really struggling and feel that for one reason or another, their child has really sort of alienated them and they're just really talking at cross purposes and it's a uncomfortable relationship, I would say get help. You know, ideally talking to a therapist, but I recognize that costs money. And not everybody has the money, and they're impossible sometimes to find. I would go back to the school, since actually, you know, all public schools have these counselors, and you can talk to the counselor a little bit about trying to repair your relationship with your child and thinking about ways to do that. So, sometimes it's important to get outside help. Now, there's another piece to this that I want to just mention is that this adolescent period. So we talked about all the potentially good things or the glass half full part of everything.
Right.
And the other side of it, as you point out, is that sometimes things do go wrong and you might be concerned that you have a child that has a substance abuse problem or maybe overly anxious. This is the time to get to the bottom of this. And I would think first talk to the pediatrician, talk to the college counselor at school. There are two pillars for you, and you just have to be the squeaky wheel and talk to them first about, are your concerns valid? What should you look for? We do know that, interestingly, mental illness has, it's most commonly has its onset in the late teen and early adult years. So college campuses deal with this all the time. There's amazing college psychology services at almost every, you know, reasonable college now is ready to prepared. As a parent, if you're connecting with your child at least regularly, you can get a barometer and there are people to reach out to. And the stigma is decreasing. And that's the very, very good news. I think with the millennials and now the generation behind the millennials, there's an openness about sharing the feeling of anxiety that one might have or depression. And kids are much more readily accessing psychiatric services and just psychological services. You know, one in four or five people have some form of, you know, mental illness. It's one of the most common maladies of humans. Mm. We have very complicated brains. Things kind of can be different. and often it comes on in this late teen, early adult window. So, you know, just to be mindful and again, stay connected.
Frances Jensen is chair of the neurology department at University of Pennsylvania and author of The Teenage Brain, a neuroscientist's survival guide to raising adolescents and young adults. Frances, thanks so much.
Well, it's been great talking to you, and happy summer, everybody.
Happy summer. Coming up, the hunt for dark matter is turning particle physics into the Wild West, and that's not a bad thing. Stay with us. We'll be back after a short break. Welcome back to Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. Dark matter is thought to make up a little over a quarter of the universe. That's six times more than all the matter ever observed. And yet, dark matter is called that because it remains a mystery. Its identity is unknown and it's never been observed. That's not for lack of trying. Millions of dollars have been poured into detectors around the world. Now the failure of those purpose-built detectors to find what they were looking for is sparking a revolution in particle physics. Researchers are letting go of preconceived notions and starting to think outside the box about ways to use any and all sensors at their disposal to get some idea of what dark matter actually is. Just in the past month, at least two different teams have announced new ideas about what dark matter might be and how they could test that. Flip Tenedo is assistant professor of physics at University of California, Riverside, and he says this is an exciting, creative, and wide open time to be a particle physicist. Flip, welcome to Living Lab Radio.
Thank you very much, Heather.
Flip, I understand you got interested in physics after reading The Physics of Star Trek. I mean, was that loaded with dark matter, or how did you focus in on dark matter?
Oh, that's a great question. Yeah, so I got into The Physics of Star Trek. This was the late 90s. It was a fantastic book. It also turned me into a Trekkie. but at the time, the particle physics community was very much geared towards one thing, and that was the Large Hadron Collider, this big puzzle about the Higgs boson, whose discovery led to a Nobel Prize in 2013. And dark matter for a long time was kind of this footnote in interesting questions in particle physics. And it wasn't actually until after I got my PhD, 2013, the same year that the Higgs won the Nobel Prize, that I made a shift in my research towards dark matter as oh, this might be the hot thing in our field.
And it's a really bizarre thing to say, we know this exists, we just can't find it. We just have no idea what it is. I mean, go back to the argument, how do we know that dark matter exists? Why does it have to exist?
Oh, excellent. So we now have a long list of reasons why we know deep in our hearts that dark matter exists. And if it does not exist, then something really, really tremendously crazy is going on. And the list of evidence for the existence of dark matter really is based in astronomy and cosmology. We can look at the motion of stars in the galaxy, in nearby galaxies. We can look at the way that starlight is bent from the gravitational pull of dark matter. But probably one of the real smoking guns for how we know dark matter is out there, and it's probably a new particle, is something called the cosmic microwave background. And this is the relic light from the first time the universe became transparent, about 400,000 years after the Big Bang. And what's really neat is this is really analogous to a musical system. So light is a wave, so is sound. So if you sat down at the piano and played middle C, then all of your listeners would know that is a piano playing a musical note. You know that it's different from a trombone playing a musical note, even if the trombone were playing the same middle C.
Right.
And the reason why they're different is because of the timbre of the sound, right? You can tell that a piano has a different set of harmonics and overtones and characteristics to how you produce that solitary note. And that tells you something about the shape and the material of the instrument. And when we look at the frequency dependence of this primordial light, it actually tells you a lot about the size and the shape of the universe. And what we see is the indelible fingerprints of some particle that is not described by our ordinary list of subatomic physics.
Well, Flip Tenedo, you've already said that dark matter is probably a new particle, some particle that we have yet to identify. And for a fair bit of time, there have been some strong ideas about what dark matter is likely to be or would turn out to be when it was eventually found. What are some of those ideas?
Yeah, so throughout most of my physics education, from high school to college through even most of my graduate education, we had this great idea for what dark matter probably was. And it was this idea of the weakly interacting massive particle, or the WIMP. And one very narrow definition of what a WIMP is that this is a new particle that interacts weakly, so through the weak nuclear force. It's massive. What type of mass? Oh, you know, around 100 times the mass of a proton. And we really liked it because it seemed to come out of our favorite theories of physics automatically. So let's go back to the mid-1990s. The biggest question in our field was, is there a Higgs boson? And if there is, why should it have the properties that we guessed it should have? And we came up with all these really exotic mathematical ideas for why the Higgs ought to behave the way that it does. And these ideas had to do with things like supersymmetry, where you produce additional force and matter particles, or extra dimensions, or maybe the idea that the things that we call fundamental particles aren't actually fundamental. And all of these ideas, which were created to solve problems with the Higgs, ended up predicting a new particle that was roughly on the order of the mass of 100 protons that interacted very weakly with ordinary matter. That was just a shoo-in, like a really obvious choice for what dark matter could be. And so for most of my physics life, we had this idea that dark matter is probably that. The moment we discover the Higgs and all of these new particles at the Large Hadron Collider, we'll also discover dark matter, and all of these cosmological hints for missing mass will be answered.
Hmm. And of course, that didn't happen. What does it mean that they haven't? I mean, it doesn't mean that dark matter doesn't exist, but does it mean that WIMPs don't exist?
Ah, yeah. So these things would detect WIMPs by the off chance that a WIMP would bounce off of one of these xenon nuclei. And the fact that we have not seen this really puts a damper on the idea that these elegant ideas of particle physics are probably also explaining what dark matter is. So I tend to say provocative things like the WIMP is dead. Like this idea of a weakly interacting massive particle is probably not the right idea. And I've gotten into fights with my colleagues, friendly fights. And I want to clarify that statement. It may well be that in the next month, the next round of data taking will discover the WIMP, something that looks and talks and quacks just like the WIMP. I mean, there are ways to make it work. But this is a research program that's been going on for almost 30 years. And it's been so thoroughly studied, and so much of the where we expected things to occur have been ruled out, that I think for me, especially as a theoretical physicist, it's time for me to move on and think, what else could we be looking for? So the interest and the efforts of the theoretical community has really moved on to, well, how do we cast a wider net?
Well, Flip Teneo, before we move on to casting that wider net, there is one group, the Dama Libra Project in Italy, that has said that they think they've found evidence of dark matter. Those claims have been disputed and really controversial. I mean, what's the debate there?
Yeah, so Dama Libra has been taking data for, I think, over 20 years. And right now, they are the only one of these experiments, these underground experiments, that have not only claimed a signal for detecting dark matter, but something called annual modulation, which is really like the creme de la creme type of signal for dark matter. And the idea is that our solar system is moving around our galaxy, and our galaxy is really sitting in a gigantic bubble of dark matter. Like our solar system is a submarine in an ocean of dark matter. And the fact that our submarine, our sun, is moving through this ocean of dark matter means that we have a headwind of dark matter that we're colliding against. And we get dragged along with the sun, but we're also orbiting the sun. And so for half of the year, we're moving with the sun against the dark matter, so we get more of a dark matter headwind. And for the other half of the year, we're moving away from the dark matter as we're rotating around the sun. And so we're getting a dark matter tailwind. And what we predict is if we have the dark matter headwind, we should be seeing more dark matter particles hitting our detectors. And when we have the tailwind, when we're retreating from the dark matter, we should have fewer. And the Dama Libra experiment claims to have actually seen this up and down signal that goes with the seasons in their detector.
But that claim has been, as we said, controversial and disputed.
That claim is absolutely very controversial. At face value, it's at least very difficult to figure out what type of particle could do this. There are other types of experiments like this that use different materials. So Dama Libra uses something called sodium iodide, which is very difficult to manufacture. But other experiments, primarily the ones based on using xenon, seem to have ruled out that type of simple theory. So there have been new experiments that are kind of doing an apples-to-apples comparison where they also use sodium iodide. And those experiments are now coming online, and the preliminary data does not corroborate the Dama Libra experiment.
So, Flip Teneo, where does that leave things? And for yourself as a theorist trying to figure out what dark matter might be, where do you turn at this point?
I'm one of a group of junior faculty who we all got our PhDs right around the time the Higgs was discovered. And the reason why this is significant is we were all educated thinking that the next big thing in particle physics would be discovered at a collider. We discover supersymmetry or extra dimensions or all of these exotic new particles that we would see at the Large Hadron Collider. And that didn't happen. Even though all of our theses had to do with all the exotic new particles we would see, we all graduated and were looking for jobs right around the time when it seemed like, oh, actually, the Large Hadron Collider discovered the thing which we knew ought to be there and nothing else.
I mean, it seems like that could be incredibly discouraging, and yet you sound excited about that.
I'm not going to lie. A lot of us, you know, had a few drinks after that. It certainly was a head scratcher. But the thing about science is the really exciting times are when nature shows you something unexpected. And here we were armed with all these tools for how do we study particle physics. And maybe the collider wasn't the place where we would be spending most of our thought. And all this time, for the past 30, 40 years, our astro and cosmology colleagues have been saying, you know, you probably have some more work to do trying to figure out what this dark matter is. This dark matter has been around for a long time. You should probably figure out where that fits into your theory of particle physics. And so a lot of where the excitement in the field is trying to be more creative and figure out what does it mean to be a particle physicist looking for dark matter at a time when all of our traditional particle physics tools have not found what we expected.
I mean, this is, it seems, even harder than finding a needle in a haystack. It's finding you don't know what in a haystack. How do you even begin to search for that?
So some of the young physicists right now are thinking about what are different types of detectors? For example, these underground detectors that we've been building are really tailored to dark matter of a certain mass range because that's the mass range that we're predisposed to in the 1990s. Now people are looking for, what if dark matter is much, much heavier? Or what if dark matter is much, much lighter? And that would require different types of materials, different types of experimental strategies. Maybe looking for dark matter in the lab is not even the right place to look. So with colleagues from the National Lab in Canada, TRIOMPHE, and in Queen's University, we've been thinking about what happens in the early universe. If we know dark matter had to be there to be the seed for our galaxy to form, maybe the fact that dark matter was around would leave some kind of imprint on the stars. And now that we have new telescopes that are looking further and further back in time, maybe that imprint can be discerned and we can distinguish different types of dark matter models. So a lot of it really has come to some kind of creative endeavor where it's not just particle physics at a collider. It's almost very primitive the way that particle physicists think about things, where our go-to tool is, if you don't see something, smash together protons harder at higher energies. But now we're starting to think, maybe we should be speaking more to our astronomy colleagues. Maybe our condensed matter colleagues or material science colleagues might have some handle on new types of detectors. It's been really a fruitful time for us to think outside of the usual particle physics box and kind of redefine what the field is becoming.
You started your career thinking that an answer to this was imminent, and a year now. Do you think that you will see an answer to this dark matter question in your career at this point?
Oh, gosh, I hope so. I really hope so. And I think part of the reason why dark matter is such an exciting thing to work on is that there is such a broad experimental program that we really do have a shot at answering this question in our lifetimes. But nature might be cruel. And I think even over the course of the next 30 years, I know we will make progress. And I think that's something I am happy with that. I know that there will be exciting things to think about over those 30 years, whether or not we have the smoking gun by the end of it.
Flip Tenedo is an assistant professor of physics at the University of California, Riverside, a theoretical physicist searching for dark matter. Flip, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much, Heather.
Until next week, this is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.
Living Lab Radio is produced by WCAI in Woods Hole and WGBH Radio in Boston. It's produced by me, Elsa Partan, and Heather Goldstone is executive producer. Funding for Living Lab Radio comes from the Candida Fund, investing in transformative leaders and ideas. Theme music by Stellwagen Symphonette.